You're listening to Big Cast, your source for financial technology innovation with John Best.
Welcome to another edition of the Big Cast. My name is Glenn Sarvati on behalf of the Best Innovation Group, and I will be honest, after the events of last week, I'm having a pretty difficult time getting myself motivated to talk about fintech today. I think there's just a few more pressing things going on. Fortunately, I don't have to find a way to pontificate for too long because I've got some great stuff to share from Theodora Lau, who's the founder of Unconventional Ventures, somebody you've probably seen speaking in a variety of venues in the fintech world. She joined us on Best Innovation Group's Digital Town Hall back in December and had some really thought-provoking comments that I think took some of her kind of expertise into the direction specifically of credit unions, digging into intergenerational wealth, student lending, and things along those lines that I hope you'll find as interesting as I did. Before we jump into that, let me just touch base on a couple of other kind of current event items that have popped up recently. And as always, I'll mention that we're here every Tuesday with new content on the Big Cast. You can find us and subscribe to us, hopefully, wherever you pick up your podcasts. And you can check out the Best Innovation Group website at big-fintech.com. A couple of things that just came to my attention. A new report that was just issued by a media company, a website called Finbold, which stands for Finance in Bold. They're a UK-based market and financial analysis website. And what they've put together is a summary of bank fines paid during 2020. And they have itemized $15 billion of fines paid in aggregate worldwide. And they've itemized those on an individual basis, 49 specific events that they came up with. They're focused only on ones that are $50,000 or 50,000 euros, I'm not sure, or higher. So it doesn't take into account the relatively small ones that come up along the way, but the big hitters. And a couple of things that, and I don't know anything about this website, and I'm usually a little bit hesitant to be referring to things that I can't vet, but taking a look at their site, it looks like they do a pretty thorough job. So I'm not vouching for it directly, but I do think, definitely take a look and see what you think. But it looks to me like pretty good information. A couple of factors here. The U.S. leads with $11 billion of the total amount of aggregate fines of $15 billion, which is pretty telling. Goldman Sachs alone was $6 billion of that over two separate fines. The U.S. also, yay for us, the top of the list from the standpoint of the number of fines, 12 out of the 49. Interestingly, the second highest number of fines was issued by China and the Chinese regulators. They had 7. However, they were such small amounts that only ranked them 9th on the overall list of total fines. They had $83 million of fines, as opposed to the U.S. It had $11 billion. Nobody else had over $1 billion, no other country, although 3 were pretty close. Australia, the Netherlands, and Israel. Netherlands and Israel doing it entirely with one single event that caused a penalty payment of over $900 million in and of itself. And they have a detail if you go out to the website. I'll post the link if you want to actually look at the individual events. Anti-money laundering seems to be the most common infraction that was cited during 2020. I was trying to see how this compared to prior years. I did not see that immediately on the website, but if I do track it down, I'll post a link to that as well. So what does this tell us? Well, first off, I'm not sure from a credit union standpoint, if we got it with a fine of that size in an individual credit union, with a couple of very rare exceptions, I think it would be kind of game over. So it's more of a big bank story. I don't know if I necessarily read this as, oh my gosh, the U.S. is the most, infraction laden geography as far as these things go. You can read it a couple of different ways, just like crime statistics. Well, does that mean that we've got more penalties that, people are doing, there's more bad acting going on? Or does it mean that we're better about actually pursuing and actually penalizing for them? And this study would not actually tell you that. I find it interesting that it would be another, I don't know how you'd get at that analysis, but I find that to be another twist on the the exercise that would be worthwhile if anybody could get at it. And then again, as I started off by saying, this is only fines of $50,000 or 50,000 euro and over. So, you know, it doesn't take into account the smaller infractions, which would be a separate exercise that I'm sure somebody could dig into as well. Anyway, something that crossed my desk that I thought you might be interested in. The other one that we've been talking about before, and it's top of mind for a lot of people, and, well, I guess a lot of things got pushed off the headlines last week, but SolarWinds, the data breach that became a pretty significant national security issue and extending beyond that, because it actually has its tentacles into a lot of private organizations, particularly financial services firms who have used SolarWinds in their back office quite a bit, and the danger of data breaches and what that means. As I say, it's gotten quieter. Some of that may just be because it's gotten crowded off of the headline pages. It also could mean that people are kind of quieting it down so they can actually deal with the behind the scenes without tipping off too much to the perpetrators, because last I heard, this was still an ongoing event. But a couple of things I noticed that I'm curious. Again, this is one where I'd love to hear from our audience. If you leave a comment at the website, or you can get in touch with us directly at my LinkedIn, Glenn Sarvati, or my Twitter at 154 Advisors, or the Best Innovation Group, at Big FinTech on Twitter. None of us have moved to Parler, by the way, so you can still find us over here. But anyway, SolarWinds, what I was going to point out is I've had a couple of instances myself where I take this as evidence that financial institutions and credit unions as well have battened down the hatches as far as maybe getting a little bit more cautious about the way they're dealing with their incoming email in this time of crisis. Totally anecdotal, but I've had two events over the course of the last week. One, and in both cases, I sent an email that was never received. Didn't bounce back to me, didn't get an alert that it was blocked. The person I sent it to, the recipient, did not get an alert that they had a blocked email that did not arrive to them. It just basically didn't happen. Fortunately, in both cases, the person I was communicating with, I had an existing line of communication with, and therefore they knew to be waiting for something from me and finally wrote back and said, "Hey, weren't you going to send this?" And I said, "I did." That we wound up tracking it down and having to get it there a different way. Which is not exactly the easiest way to do business. In one of the cases, it was even a direct reply to an email they sent. So my suspicion is this is something that's adding greater filtering and diligence on emails originating from outside somebody's own institution. But again, the two things that happened, in one case, there was an attachment that I had sent to somebody with some information that was requested. I've seen that before, particularly at financial institutions, that attachments over a certain size from an outside source get sanitized and pulled out. Usually they're at least people are told it's being sent. In this case, it was a very small attachment, and we wound up finding a workaround. The other one I found far more interesting is, and I've seen this a lot in terms of dealing with spam in personal email addresses. Apparently, this organization was looking at keywords in the email and then filtering out and rejecting emails if certain words were used. I've seen this before, and I'm guessing you have as well, especially in the subject line. Specifically remember seeing that usually the word Viagra is not spelled out. They usually use a couple of asterisks to try to get past any kind of a filter along those lines. I have not seen that applied before within the body of an email, however. And in this case, after a little bit of trial and error that my colleague at this organization and I did just to kind of test this out, we determined that the word that was the offender was Bitcoin, which I find really interesting because we were actually communicating about a business situation in terms of the analysis of the impact of Bitcoin on financial institutions. But you can't say Bitcoin or else the email gets actually filtered out. And the belief is, and it's a perfectly logical belief, that a lot of suspicious emails make a request in the body of their message saying they want payment in Bitcoin. But that obviously may be a bridge too far in terms of filtering out more than was intended. If anybody else has any knowledge of exactly what kind of steps have been taken to become a little bit more strict and tightening up security, of incoming messages. I'd love to hear about it. And obviously, we can shield any kind of identifying information so we don't disclose anything that you're not comfortable with. But if you'd like, if you're comfortable sharing anything, please pass along and we'll have a further discussion in the coming weeks. Anyway, with no further ado, our main attraction here, as I mentioned, the Digital Town Hall, which we'll post a link to as well, takes place on most Wednesdays. John Best and Mike Lawson from our friends at CU Broadcast moderate these panels. Great discussion of information sharing of best demonstrated practices, et cetera, for the credit union industry. Takes place kind of afternoon time East Coast, around lunchtime for the West Coast. On Wednesdays, runs about an hour, and has a series of very thought-provoking guests, and the one that we had in mid-December was Theodora Lau, who is the founder of Unconventional Ventures. She focuses, and her firm focuses, on addressing customers and consumers' unmet needs. That includes the typical kind of financial inclusion that we often talk about, but she actually takes that a bit broader to other underserved areas that really have needs that, for whatever reason, have not really been fully addressed by the market, such as older consumers. And that's really where we wound up having this conversation around intergenerational wealth, student lending, where I think a lot of people kind of miss out on the fact that the older generation is often a co-signer on student loans. So this is not purely a millennial and Gen Z issue dealing with the payback of student loans. And then even things like caregivers, whether that's a paid caregiver or a family member who then needs to be dealing with the increasing, you know, aging population in this U.S. that continues to have financial needs. It's all, in my mind, it went off into a very interesting direction, talking about the legacy of where credit unions came from and how this directly applies to how credit unions work as the intergenerational transfer of wealth takes place and the overall kind of aging of the credit union population, which we've known for some time is an issue as well. With that, let's jump into a portion of the conversation that took place with Theo Lau.
One of the biggest areas that we look at is longevity, as in the case of older adults. So in that perspective, we like to call them the forgotten demographics, for lack of better terms, because many people, they are more inclined to run off to the so-called digital natives, but they forgot the fact that much of the technology is actually built and created by people that are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. And that market...
So don't stop you there. I like you already. I think I saw Tom smile.
Uh-oh.
You said 70s, you covered Kevin's demographics. That's good.
That's good. Mine too. I'm almost 50.
Oh, wow. Wait, congrats, you do not
what,
like.
What am I supposed to make of that? I'm trying to figure out. I have Asian genes.
I turned 50 this week, so.
Yippee!
A couple weeks ago. Yeah, it's bad. Things are confusing. I don't know what's happening. It's been a bad upgrade.
50 is the new 30. So for those who are interested, since the early 1900s, we have gained an extra 30 years of living, which means that right now you are 20 years old. Congratulations.
I just finished Ready Player Two. And in that, the end of it was basically this idea of, well, I don't want to give
it away. Wait, no, don't do that, John.
Okay.
No.
I stopped. All right.
Uh-oh.
Spoiler alert.
Melissa put a stop to it. So that's the market that we're really interested in, because if you think about it, they are the ones that own over 80% of the assets in the United States. They're the ones with the money. Why do we keep running after people that are broke? And on top of it, what we are seeing as an opportunity is caregivers. So over 60-some percent of caregivers in the United States are in the late 40s. They are women. They are planning for their own retirement. They have some sort of assets, but they're also looking after the financial for their loved ones, for their parents, in-laws, and what have you. That market, I would say, is completely ignored, because they have needs that we're not thinking about. If we think about, for example, student loans, right? A lot of times we think about student loans as a millennial problem, but it is, I would argue and defer, that is not completely true. One of the fastest growing demographic of people that are going, taking up student loans are those that are over 65. And for the last few years, they are also one of the fastest group of people that are going default. They're the ones that are picking up loans, not just for themselves, but also for their kids, for their grandkids, right? They're the ones that are pitching in holidays if they need to get anything. they're also the ones who, because of the fact that they have assets, they have real estate, they're the ones that are co-signing the loans. And so if you think about from a financial services perspective, there's much that we can do for that particular demographic. We think about aging, we think about decline, we think about retirement, but it's not so much so because a lot of the people are still saving, they're still working, they need help planning, and the complexities of our financial lives have gotten so much more so that you need to move beyond spreadsheets, right? That's yeah. what we use tech for.
So it's interesting to me because what you're saying really resonates. And when I look at somebody who's sort of, anytime like Brett and I kick around the future, Brett King, I try to just kind of, you know, relate it back to my real life. So my wife just finished getting a new degree because she's been working in the government sector in accounting, and she wanted to get a degree in, that was particular to this kind of government accounting. And so you're exactly right. We also paid for both of our kids, one of my kids' student loans, the other one opted, you know, to stay out of college so far. But we definitely would be in that pace. And then I look at the idea that you're talking about sort of the you know, planning for retirement and what they're doing. And so what I think is happening, and it sounds like this is what you're alluding to, is that right now I think that we're all sort of just out-earning the spend. And what I mean by that is just, you know, outrunning the spend of what you have. But there aren't really any, like, for, you know, you just touched on something I never thought of, but it's a really good point. Now, I think, Kevin, you're in the same boat as me. Maybe you're not. But, you know, I've got my daughter's current, you know, college loan for, you know, CU. And I don't know if any, I never even considered any way to reorganize that or what to do with it, because it's kind of hers, but mine, I don't, you know, it's this confusing sort of financial application that I'm not 100%. Like SoFi, I don't think would work for me, for them. And so I don't know where to go with that. I think you're hitting on something. But I will take a counterpoint that I hear a lot, and I don't think it's true, but it's something I hear a lot, which is, why are we running after the millennials when they're broke? Well, that's our problem, is we're kind of hooked on their habits, which create fee income. And that's something we see a lot. So there are a lot of folks. As a matter of fact, we had this discussion just previously with a lot of other credit unions, and Kevin Wright, who's on the call, shared with me that he did research into this because he was looking into a way to sort of help for courtesy pay, Theo. And he was thinking, hey, I'm going to help these guys out. And basically when he reached out to them, they said, hey, I don't need your help. My paychecks are kind of intermittent, and I'm okay with, I consider them just small loans to cover me while I'm, you know, in between these jobs and this new gig economy that's sort of emerging. So is that something that you hear as well in terms of that? And is it wrong to sort of, you know, I sometimes worry that that is a business model that will fall apart, because if you just keep feeing people, it's just like a captured business model. It doesn't seem like the Blockbuster business model. You know, it's like eventually people aren't going to want to bring the tapes back.
Eventually it's going to catch up to you. Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things about millennials that we don't typically think about, a quarter of these caregivers that I was just talking about, they are millennials.
Yeah, I keep forgetting, right? That they're heading to their 30s now.
They're
yeah.
getting older. Eventually, yeah. They'll need something a little bit more than, you know, just a beautiful app on the phone.
Yeah. So is that, well, first of all, I want to qualify some. Kevin, do you have any loans for the kids, college-wise?
Are you talking about me, Kevin?
Yeah, you, Kevin.
Yeah. We luckily have been able to pretty much fund the kids' stuff through stuff we did early.
Are you one of those dudes that like took that, hey, we'll pay for your entire kids' college if you pay $5 a month thing?
No, not one of those. But we're lucky. And I think the other danger, I think, that I've heard with people is, and you know, and sometimes the kids take out the loan and you co-sign and forget about it. And then later on, one of the kids runs into trouble, goes delinquent. It not only impacts their credit score, but it impacts your credit scores and your ability to get credit to pay those things off. And it becomes a multi-generational problem in that family, you know, and not an easy one to get out of.
Hey, John. Yeah, so I can speak to this as both.
Hey, Tom, Theo doesn't know who you are, so maybe give a quick
introduction. Oh, hi, Theo. Tom O'Shea.
I'm kind of a close-knit family here sometimes.
So
I feel like this is like an enclave I'm walking into.
Walked into a bar, a bad bar, and like there was a bunch of old white men around the counter.
I thought you just described our industry.
Yeah. Maybe it was that Star Wars bar that we're all at, John.
Yeah, I love that bar. Go ahead.
I'm Tom O'Shea. I'm the CEO of Aspire Federal Credit Union in Clark, New Jersey. And I can speak on this on two different levels. One is a lender and the second is a parent. So as a lender, we see, and we lend on private student loans. But what we do is we see students getting their federal loan. And then we come in and make up the difference. And we have the student. And then in 95% of the cases, we have a parent. And often it's a grandparent that co-signs that loan for that student. And then as a parent, you also have the PLUS loan. So you have three different, you know, the first student's loan is a fixed amount, and then it's never enough. So you always need supplemental borrowing. And so whether it's a private loan or the parent going out their PLUS loan, those two, the private loan and the PLUS loan, are basically unlimited. They're whatever remaining cost of that education are. And it all becomes very problematic once that kid starts to graduate and needs to start paying that back. And as a parent, I can tell you, you know, having put three of my four kids through college, I have my fair share currently of PLUS loans that I'm still paying for. And you know, then you're also trying to help your kids out with their loans as they're trying to get built up and, you know, have a life and get a house and all. And it's a very complex and massive problem all across this country.
So going back to what Theo was sort of saying, and this kind of makes sense to me. So Theo, when we look at the composition, remember this is all credit unions. When we look at the composition of credit unions, we find that there's this kind of 80-20 rule. And it's that 20% are carry-ins or the other 80%. Because remember, a credit union is supposed to be a co-op. And so in that mode, people are all supposed to be participating evenly. When we look at that 20%, it definitely represents the demographic you're talking about. It certainly bears out what you're saying in the sense of the rural, not rural, but the suburban / rural mother caregiver, I think is what the term you used. That's the person that's running household finances that is the joint or the senior on the account, and then there's a joint. And when we look at those accounts that account for the assets of the credit unions, it's generally a 20-80 rule. Tom, are you still experiencing that as well?
Yeah, I mean, that rule holds off from assets as well as member usage and profitability across the board. Yeah.
So go ahead, Theo. So from that, with that perspective, I'm validating your thoughts, but I was just throwing a couple other ideas out that we do hear a lot of people who are after the millennials because they see them as a recurring revenue source of courtesy pay. So, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, so why couldn't we also look at millennials a different way, looking at more intergenerational solutions, right? Don't look at them just for X that you can charge fees on, but look at them as in the family. You're helping out the family, you're helping out the grandparents. Tom, to your point, a lot of these co-signers are grandparents. And some of the stats that we've seen the last few years is far from promising. For example, you talked about federal student loans, right? The amount of people that have defaulted, the amount of older people, older than 65, that have defaulted on federal student loans have increased by 500%. And what that does is that their Social Security payments got garnished, I believe, to 15% or so. That also impacts their long-term financial security. And then it has a trickle-down impact. In financial services, a lot of times people like to talk about wealth transfer. But if you do not take care of the finances of the older people that are taking care of the younger generation, how on earth are you going to have wealth transfer? They need help to better manage their money. They need help to plan better. They need, as a family unit between the grandparents and the parents and the children, there needs to be a better solution for them to help figure out the complex web of their financial lives.
So with that in mind, that's something that concerns me. So I've just recently been doing a lot of homework on Chime. I assume you're pretty familiar mm-hmm. with them. And, you know, one of the things that concerns me is that they are just driving up the new bank accounts, right? I mean, they're getting a large percentage of them. One, because they figured out something that we were having a deep discussion on, which is the new algorithms in Google that have changed quite a bit from what we think they are. And a lot of people are sort of operating as though we're still in 2017, 18, and we're not. And we're in this new world where Google is operating in a completely different way. Which, but that said, as we look at what's happening with them, so is the danger that you're sort of communicating that Tom's grandparent member who did the Plus account for the, not the next generation, but the next generation beyond that, so the grandchild, who is entering college now. So you're looking at probably a baby boomer and then a Gen X or a Gen Y and then a millennial kid. So you're really kind of three generations, mm-hmm. one of those three, however it's playing out. And is there a danger in your mind that when this other person passes on, unfortunately, that money would then transition to Chime? Or does Chime not have, you know, they don't have loans, they don't have enough financial services to sort of take on what will eventually be the needs? Do you see them transitioning out of that? And this is back to that fintech longevity discussion. Do you see them either Chime transitioning into those services with partnerships and things, which they have a lot of that, or do you see, would the, how would Tom entice that person to come over to Aspire? And there, are there things he can do now? Which I think I'm setting you up for a softball here, but I think
I'm trying to think of how I should answer that. I think there is definitely a role to play, right, for Tom's credit union and community banks. That's why we love credit unions, is because what they do and what they stand for is different, right? You stand for what it means to be a community, although that's changing as well. But you are creating something that will benefit that household and the household beyond. I don't think I would be as worried about the money. I'm gonna get smacked on social media soon. I won't be as worried about that money going off to Chime just because of the sheer financial troubles that we're seeing a lot of people running into. I think if there is a way, and I know there is a way, that we can collectively as an industry prove to them that there are things we can help with beyond just thinking about gouging them on fees, beyond just thinking about, you know, the traditional. We literally just came out from a call with a client that we need to move beyond just thinking about annuities and things of that nature when we think about aging. There are a lot of things we can do. So for example, John, I know you love technology, right? We're thinking about AI. What can AI do? AI can do more than just give you like a beautiful card. You can use that to safeguard your finances. Because you can use that, there are startups that are out there that uses AI machine learning to create profiles of people looking at years of their spending habits, looking at anomalies, looking across accounts, because you have more than one financial relationship, and looking at what things might be wrong and flag it to your circle of trusted people in your house, for lack of better terms, right? There are things that you can do. There are ways that you can help them better manage cross obligations, if you will. Going back to caregiver example, right? Somebody like me, I always like to use myself as an example because I feel that pain. I'm in my late 40s. I have two children. I need to think about their college. I am not as lucky as Kevin, you that, you know, it's all paid off. I have two I have to think about. I have my parents who unfortunately have moved overseas because they could not afford the healthcare in this country, right? So think about the complexities of my life. And I have a business I'm running. I need to think about how to support that. And on top of it, I need to think about what the heck am I going to do in 50 years? Because most likely I still will be alive, hopefully. So if you put all of that in an equation, how do I do that? How do I even go about thinking of how should I put money away for my kids? How should I put money away for my parents should and when they would need it and help them? And how would I do that? And how do I support my business and myself? So if you think about complexities of our lives, the fact that we're living longer, but not just longer, you're having more generations living alongside each other. What can credit unions do in that sense? They've been with you for a long time.
It sounds like what you're advocating for, and this is something, you're right, I love this concept, is the idea, when you say an equation, you know, that's a great way to put it, because it really is what AI is really good at, which is taking past at this point and putting it together and coming up with that. Tariq just posted a comment. There was a couple comments I want to bring to our attention.
End of life.
End of life is a good one. I think we used to do a lot of that. You know, Tom, I remember when Craigians had a lot of trusts, was a big thing that was out there. There were a lot of that sort of services. Suncoast did that for years. And then it felt like it kind of became, unfashionable. I don't know what the word is, but it just
unsexy.
Didn't seem like that. Yeah, it didn't seem like that service. It felt like advisor was the bigger, robo-advisor, you know, investment advisor, those sorts of things was, I guess, and part of it, I think, is because the previous generation dealt with death a lot differently than this one in terms of, like, you know, you're looking at the next generation was the primary focus of those that at the time weren't at that end of life. You know, I'm talking like the 80s, the 90s. And as they look, as I look at their, you know, what they were doing, they were much more realistic about that transition planning. Baby boomers, you know, kind of, I think, went a different way. And they were looking more at accumulated wealth and then the long-term wealth of that. And they lived longer. I think Theo put that as a good portion. We've talked about this before. I mean, Theo, you make a good point that I've had this discussion many times, but is a 30-year mortgage still the thing? If people are going to live till they're, you know, 30 years, you know, would you say average? I'm now 20. That's great for me. So this house could be financed 45-year mortgage maybe, and that would change the equation for a lot of households in terms of the output for that funding. But the AI concept of taking all that, and it sounds like you're advocating and sort of predicting, and I think you're right, some sort of service where you dump in, you know, 10 years of your financial history, your health and a couple other things, and it pops out with you need to do A, B, and C and do, you know, X, Y, and Z. And this is what things look like for the most part, unless there's some sort of, something happens that's unpredicted, like this pandemic. Even then, now that it knows about that, it may be able to put, you know, some of that sort of chaos theory into the equation.
Isn't that more interesting than telling you how much money you spend in Starbucks last month?
Oh, absolutely. If it could predict my death and how, that would be even better. But my wife's already got that figured out. But that you know, that's why she keeps taking insurance out on me, I'm pretty sure. But Paul was just saying, Paul is from Ukrainian in New Mexico. He's on the show pretty regularly. He was saying that he sees a large account roll-off. So he's seeing a lot of older members where the money's starting to go out. So people are starting to monitor their outbound ACH, which is generally how that's being. And then they're not seeing new income coming in, which for us is kind of an early predictor of attrition. So it's sort of bearing out what you're saying. But you said not to be so worried about that. So you think that, because one thing that's happened in the Ukrainian space is we used to be exactly kind of what you said, which was this big family monolith, right? And some still are. But then we began to sort of swim with the sharks and bigger worlds where, Tom, what would you say between 1990 and now, or Andrew, or anybody wants to pipe up, like, the, you know, I can remember when you had a household and in the 90s, like, everybody was part of the credit union. Now I look at that and I don't think that's the trend anymore, but maybe I'm wrong. What's your thoughts there?
Well, I think there's two parts to that, John. One is that around that time, actually, it was when credit unions started to expand their fields of membership. And Theo alluded to this in the beginning. She made a sort of an offhanded comment about the community and the growth and whatnot. And that's true. And so you get further disconnected from that employer base or from that very small local community. So you don't know everyone. You don't totally understand what their needs are. So you are now cherry picking and what type of member or where's the most lucrative or profitable member. And then things have gotten far more complex. So people are doing things with, you know, Robinhood. You might have a little money with Robinhood. You've got your business checking account with Aslo, a fintech. You might have a personal with N26. You might all these different fintechs you could be using. And it becomes very complex for somebody to manage it, which I think is where it could come back to the traditional FI, because we have the banking license. Most of these fintechs realize that they can't manage, afford, have the expertise to get a bank charter or a credit union charter, if that was even in the picture. So they tend to partner with them. So we have an opportunity to either work with the fintech or to potentially bring it back in when people look at their financial lives and say, wow, I'm just all over the place. They might now go back to a spreadsheet just to track who they're doing business with, you know, and then go into those apps and so on. So I think so I think there's a couple parts to it that created the disintermediation where we've been losing money as the older generation passes that money on to the younger. But then we become more of a throwback to potentially a simpler or a more organized financial life for somebody.
So Theo, that's kind of what you're saying is you think that that's where you say don't worry because you feel like eventually they've got to come back to the mothership.
I think there is more that credit unions can offer that people can relate to. Now, I am curious though, Tom, I have a question for you. With all of with everything that we've been through, right, for the last 9 months, people working at home, people staying at home. I know a lot of friends of mine that have moved away from their city and moving back with their parents or going back to, you know, where they were born and stuff. Would that trigger part of that coming back to the community and banking where their parents are?
I think it potentially could because and I was going to comment on something you said earlier too that ties in with this is, you know, we go after the millennials, even though they're quote broke or all, because we're hoping if we have the grandparent and the parent and the child that as the estate passes down, it stays with us. Because right now we tend to lose it because we had the parent at your employer, but the kid is in New York or LA or Chicago. If they come back to their, you know, their hometown, that does help us, gives us the opportunity to start to become more aware, maybe top of mind for that child if they're seeing us with their parent, and gives us a chance to try to market and promote and show them the difference, the cooperative community nature of a credit union and how we're there for them. We've been there for, you know, decades and so on.
So as I mentioned, there's a lot more where that came from. That's about a third of the conversation that I think took place on that digital town hall. And I'll post a link if you want to go back and listen to the full session that ran just about an hour. And in case you didn't pick that up, the other voice, the Tom that you heard contributing pretty significantly to that conversation is our good friend Tom O'Shea, who's the CEO at Aspire Credit Union in New Jersey. Always a good thought-provoking thought leader in the space as well. And there will be more digital town halls coming up. If you're interested in joining, just drop a note either at the website or just send one of us a message, John or I, and we'll make sure that you get an invitation and a link to those sessions. With that, another episode of The Big Cast. Again, my name is Glenn Sarvati. You can find me at my firm, 154 Advisors, on Twitter at 154 Advisors. You can find the Best Innovation Group on the web at on Twitter at Big Fintech. Online at big-fintech.com. You can find all of our history in the archive of literally hundreds at this point of these past episodes on the podcast link and lots of other information about the services provided by the Best Innovation Group. Until next time, again, as always, thanks very much for listening.
Got a question or want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Big Fintech. Email us at info@big-fintech.com or visit our show notes and comments at www.bigfintechmedia.com.